This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me the historians Mary Jo and Paul Buell. They're editors of an excellent new book called It Started in Wisconsin, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Labor Protest. And I've got to give a full disclosure, since I've got a chapter in this book, and Mary Jo and Paul are friends of mine. Mary Jo and Paul Buell, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt.
Thanks so much.
So you were here when this started. What was your reaction at the very beginning?
Well, I think surprise. We came out in early February following the Teaching Assistance Association delivery of the fake Valentines to Governor Walker, where they proclaimed their love of the university. And the next day, as many people know, Madison teachers were out to protest the curtailment of collective bargaining rights for all state employees. And so we just joined the crowds at the Capitol and were immediately impressed by the size and energy. And then we just stayed with it for day after day after day, and then into the late spring, and watched the momentum grow.
Paul, these were different than your average Madison protests. I mean, I've been to a lot over the last 30 years here, and they weren't the usual suspects, or they were the usual suspects plus tens of thousands of other suspects.
Yeah, I guess I would add that Mary Jo and I came to graduate school here in September of 1967. Consequently, we were here for the Dow police riot. We were here for the campus anti-war movement. We were here through 1971, which means the only thing we missed was Paul Soghilan's election.
So how did this compare, these protests compare?
Yeah, I have thought often that when we in our 60s are inclined to say about the 60s, we were surrounded by young people like us with long hair and so on, and now we're astonished that we're old and we're surrounded by old people. A misstatement in both cases. Madison was loaded with older peacenik types and progressive types in the 1960s and early 1970s, the apex of the peace movement. But the truth is, we didn't so much see them because we young types outnumbered them probably 20 to 1. But they were there at all the major events. Likewise, in the current period, it's true that you see a lot of people who are 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and even older, but you also see plenty of people who are quite young. I think maybe one of the most astonishing things, it's something we never saw in the 1960s, are parents with babes in arms, and for that matter, elderly people in wheelchairs. So the demography is perfectly startling. And even if the movements of 40 years ago were very much youth-dominated, they sure look different now.
Yeah, I'd like to just add that being with Paul during the demonstrations on campus during the 1960s, I remember that one of our aspirations was to be able to reach past the university community and out into the public, and especially to get people from the working populations and labor. And to me, through the whole protest here, one of the things that stood out was the number of union people involved. And the kind of pride of identity that the union people carried into it. Marching behind all of these big, brawny guys with their leather jackets and union insignias on the back was something that I had fantasized as a young woman, of course, but I had fantasized as a young protester in the 1960s, and of course, was very far from the reality. The second aspect of it that stood out to me was the number of women involved in it. Certainly women were involved in the anti-war protests in the 1960s, but having been there myself, I know the marginalization sort of reaped by the image of the street-fighting man that was so popular during that era meant that they were not nearly as visible as they were here. And, of course, this being a strike, really, almost a general strike of people who were state employees. A large percentage now are teachers, nurses, social workers, and so that women were really on the front lines here. So it was a very different, not just in terms of age, but also in terms of the composition of a sort of like teachers plus union folks plus old plus young, but a lot of women at the forefront.
And one of the leaders of the public sector workers, teachers union was at the on the podium speaking at almost every rally, as were other women. There, this sense of class consciousness, though, that you were talking about, Mary Jo Buell and Paul Buell, my guests today, it just kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, you hear the expression solidarity, you know, the great old song, and it's kind of hackneyed, but we really did see and are still seeing here in Wisconsin and with the Occupy movement, the sense of solidarity. And here in Wisconsin, especially across every working occupation, public sector workers, private sector workers, they try to divide public sector workers from public sector workers by carving out the police and the firefighters, and that didn't work. And this was what struck me at the very beginning, just how widespread this movement was.
Yes, as I've been a labor historian through part of my career, and so I was always interested in the peculiarities of Wisconsin labor history and the peculiarities of Madison labor history within that. And of course, Wisconsin has, it's in many ways, a remarkably, to the point of unique labor history, because socialists were the head of the State Federation of Labor in the 19th and early 20th century. Milwaukee had socialist mayors until 1960. There were some dramatic, important, and often tragic strikes from the 1880s through the 1960s. To that, I'd add that Mary Jo and I were both members of the Teaching Assistants Association at UW when we won a contract in 1970, so we have a deep personal interest. But it's an interesting footnote that the Madison labor movement, dominated pretty much by the building trade through the 1950s and 1960s, was known through much of the state as a pretty conservative union town. It was a white-collar town that also had factories. But you wouldn't say that labor leadership was on the progressive side. And then came what one might call the radicalization of the city in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, when it drew more and more people who were of a progressive sentiment from around the state and around the country. And some very remarkable figures emerged in the labor movement, including a former president of the Teaching Assistants Association, David Newby, who became president of the State Federation of Labor. And so there's an evolution that pointed in the direction we've reached, but I'm quite sure that labor figures within the city and the state never imagined that there would be such a public acclamation and support of unions, or on the other hand, there would be so many union members, for me, interestingly, including many, many retired unionists from places that had shut down and moved out of the state, who rushed from wherever they were to the state capitol and joined with a sense of solidarity that they'd hoped to see in their lifetimes. So in those ways, in the sense that unions seem to represent to a very wide public what we've been able to build, what we've been able to accomplish, the things that we're proud of. We felt it was there before, but never expressed in this vivid and remarkable fashion.
Mary Jo, what would you add to that?
I think it marks the sort of coming of age of public sector unionism to a very large extent. We all know that the shift, especially dramatic in Wisconsin with the close of industries in Kenosha and Racine, and especially machine tools in Milwaukee, have necessitated a shift away from skilled crafts and even in industrial factory-based unions and into the service trades and white collar trades. But I think the outpouring of people in Madison around public employees marked this stage in very vivid terms. I also think it's very interesting that the private sector unions came out in massive support for the public sector workers, which, getting back to the title of our book, if I can plug it, it started in Wisconsin. It just seems to me to drive home the point of what's going on in the other Republican-dominated states. For example, in Indiana, the right-to-work laws that they're trying to push through, I think that ordinarily I would say that would be next on the agenda for Wisconsin, given Walker's program. But I kind of think he's going to hold off for a while.
He did try to divide public sector workers versus private sector workers, saying you in the public sector have all these health benefits and pension benefits that most people in the private sector don't have, so why should you have it? And that just didn't seem to be a seller. I mean, that is the ultimate race to the bottom philosophy. Why do you think it didn't catch on? And was it unique to Wisconsin? I mean, your book, it started in Wisconsin. Are you suggesting that if it hadn't started here, it wouldn't have started anywhere?
I think that the title and the theme placed themselves between the Arab Spring in the summer and the fall. We sometimes forget there were very widespread events in Europe as well, especially young people resisting the destruction of the social state. But between the Arab Spring on the one hand and the Occupy movement on the other, what lies between those two world historic events? We proudly say the events in Wisconsin, and we think of the occupation of the Capitol that went on for several weeks with such enormous publicity as our initiating version of Occupy.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that, too. One of the things of putting this book together that sort of propelled us forward was the question of what is unique about Wisconsin. And as others have pointed out, the public sector unions started here. AFSCME, for example, started in Wisconsin in the 1930s. And then, of course, we have state recognition of the right to collective bargaining in the late 1950s, so that Wisconsin has this, in some ways, a unique heritage or legacy of honoring public sector unions that very few states have. And one of the things that struck me all the way through the protests of last spring was this really vivid sense of people being part of a Wisconsin movement. People were always quoting Robert La Follette. People had signs on their back about La Follette, and that legacy is, I think, it's unique to Wisconsin, and it's still quite alive. And I don't think that's true of some of the other GOP-dominated states.
You know, it strikes me that the lesson to draw from this is not only to celebrate Wisconsin's progressive tradition, but for people in other states to seize their own and recover and excavate and celebrate their own progressive traditions, because there are progressive streams in every state and progressive heroes in every state. And you, as historians of the American left, know that better than probably anybody. But and so why don't you speak to that? I mean, here in Wisconsin, there's been a concerted effort to celebrate that tradition with Fighting Bob Fest, which Ed Garvey, the great labor lawyer and candidate for office here, has held now for more than a decade. And it brings to life, it keeps alive this tradition, as do, you know, other things that are going on. But surely this can happen in other states too.
Yeah, I think that we're never sure how hard the opposition is going to try to efface the traditions of Robert La Follette. The business magazine of the city, Madison Magazine, has a special feature in a current issue on the 100 years of the Wisconsin tradition, the Wisconsin idea. Robert La Follette's name is missing. Teddy Roosevelt, a non-Wisconsinite, turns out to be the great prophet for Wisconsin. Well, isn't that a surprise? I think that for the wider U.S. public, the memory of Franklin D. Roosevelt still looms large, because so many things, from Social Security to the right to form unions and so forth, are part of that common heritage that's been chopped away out since the 1980s, and which the Republicans would like to do away with altogether. But what emerges slightly behind that, or on the side of that, is that the New Deal was in many ways a product of farmer labor movements, socialist movements, even communist movements, and personalities and struggles that had gone on since at least the 1870s and 1880s and arguably before. And what the New Deal did was to codify some of those things in a slightly diluted form and make them, put them into law, but also bring together a large coalition of liberals and radicals in Washington, D.C., but also across the country to work to not only bring them into existence, but to extend them into a broader social vision and a more cooperative society. That fails by the time the Cold War comes around, but the idea and ideals of it never entirely disappear.
Mm-hmm. And Mary Jo Buell, how would you recommend that people exhume some of this progressive history in their own state?
Well, I was just thinking while Paul was talking that on the day that Wisconsinites turned over their recall petitions for counting and verification, people in Michigan were waging a huge protest against the governor and his accession of the right to take over cities that he deemed were in trouble. So I do think it is happening in other states. The pushback in Michigan that recently was extremely important and made a nice sort of counterpoint to what was going on in Wisconsin. I think what's a little bit different in Wisconsin compared to some of the other states is what I think is very similar to what Paul was saying, is that in some ways the history has been eradicated from people's collective memories more effectively than it has here. I would suspect in New York you could make a similar case to Wisconsin, that there are always these pockets of resistance that have held on through the dark eras. But I think given the sense of what's going on in the state here, that it's slightly more continuous kind of memory.
And Paul, your sense is that maybe just seizing on FDR is the best way to go nationally or state to state?
I think that it's the most reachable, attainable sort of thing. I think that in many places, the obvious heritage which lies before the anti-war movements of the 1960s is the civil rights movement. But it's difficult to, for some reason, to seize upon the incredibly rich legacy of the civil rights movement in resisting the imposition of a draconian attack on welfare, social wages, and so on. Given that difficulty, in some way or other, the New Deal and the vision of Social Security as the symbol of a social state seems to be precious, valuable, and meaningful.
It's interesting because some of the songs were from the New Deal era and some of the songs were from the Civil Rights Movement,
right,
that the activists in Wisconsin were singing.
And some of the songs are adaptations from Civil War songs, which brings us back to the German-American, among other volunteers, to go and end slavery, including my great-great-grandfather, a farmer abolitionist across the border in Illinois. So that's sort of there, too. It's a grand struggle against the forces of oppression and exploitation. And to be in Madison and other parts of Wisconsin during this recall struggle was to see people joining together in what would almost be called a spiritual crusade, but in other terms could be described as a loving community, a group, a very, very large group of people who recognize each other as friends and part of a movement, and a good-spirited movement at that. Perhaps the most amazing thing about the events around the Capitol, huge demonstrations, among many amazing things, is that each demonstration would bring more new, really funny homemade signs. And a major attraction, along with the polka music that was played, and sometimes people would polka toward the end of demonstrations, a remarkable thing, was the going around and saying, gee, that's just a great sign. That's so funny. And people took enormous pride in these slogans of dozens and hundreds of uniquely created ones. And that's the way you understand that a social movement of wide character and grassroots meaning has really begun and won't go away soon.
Mary Jo, I'd like you to talk about this too, because this character of the Wisconsin Uprising is so striking to me, as Paul was saying. I was remembering the festival nature of these protests, how exuberant it was. People in costumes, on stilts, with masks on, and hilarious homemade signs.
Tractors.
And there was the tractor pole. There was everything, that, you know, the tractorcade around the Capitol. But it wasn't just anger. There was much more going on there, and it was fun to participate in it.
Yes, I think that's really important, that a really successful social or political movement has to be sort of like culturally embracing of people and give them not only a reason for being there, but a joy in being there. And that certainly was the experience of almost everyone that was at the Capitol and continues to go on well into this spring. When the Solidarity Sing-Along, which is one of our favorite events, this was something that was organized last February and has been continuous every weekday since then. It's something approaching now number 300 sing-along at the Capitol. And anywhere between 30 to 200 people show up on a daily basis singing inside the Capitol Rotunda, or if there's a conflict, they sing outside. And little pickup bands come and people play and people do dance polkas at the end of it. But it is a wonderful thing. And I've gone many times, but when we get to certain songs, I am always crying. Crying because it's such a moving moment to see the participation of people and to think of it as having a really good time. The other thing that we would notice is that the crowds in the Capitol and around the Capitol adopted something that I believe happens at other kinds of sort of large fun events, is thanking people for their participation. Whenever a group of visiting unionists would come, people would shout, "Thank you, thank you, thank you." Or when the firefighters would march through, there was that sense that appreciation had to be expressed. And I think people, you know, deserve that and like it. I know that I remember watching a group of unionists who drove all the way from Los Angeles late last February, and it was snowing here, and they were woefully underdressed. And everyone went up to them and were shaking their hands, said, "Thank you so much for coming." And they says, "Oh, it's the most wonderful moment of my life." And that had a lot to do with the reciprocity between the visitors and the people at home and that spirit.
I'm speaking with Mary Jo and Paul Buell. They are historians by trade, and they are scholars of the American left. And they're editors of this excellent new book called It Started in Wisconsin, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Labor Protest. Paul, you've got a chapter in here with labor scholar and activist Frank Emsbach, in which the question is raised as to whether all this effort into the recalls was the only road to take and whether it was wise to funnel everything that way. Now, after January 17th, when more than a million petitions have been signed and it looks like Walker may indeed be recalled, do you still think that's a valid criticism?
Well, it's an interesting criticism. I think that difficulty lies in the recent decades' experience of the labor movement and the Democratic Party. The weaker the labor movement became from the 1960s onward, the more dependent it became on elections, and the less dependent it was upon organizing its own workers, mobilizing its own members to do things, including a strike, but also create new unions and all kinds of activities. More and more weight was put upon the Democratic Party. So that when it appeared as if a moment might be taking shape in which a general strike would be proclaimed throughout the state, outsiders from Detroit and Chicago, New York, who were involved in labor for decades past, said, "Well, this is the moment. This whole everyone in the state should go on strike." And what they didn't observe was the disappearance of those 14 Democratic state senators from Wisconsin, Illinois, opened up the space for all of the other activities to take place. In other words, regardless of any history of the Democratic Party and the labor movement in Wisconsin, which is complex and contradictory, there was a relationship between what happened in the electoral and political arena and what working people, members of state unions or other unions or no unions were going to do. And indeed, state employees felt as if they needed to stay on the job after a bit of a sick out by teachers for the first week because they needed to demonstrate that they were the ones who were being responsible. It was the Republican governor and his supporters who were irresponsible. That being the case, the direction things went was indeed toward the electoral arena and everything connected with it. And in my mind, people who continue to make the criticism and ask the question, well, what mediocre Democrat is now going to be elected governor after all the struggle? The people who say that sort of miss the main point, which is the mobilization and education of tens and hundreds of thousands of people over the last 11 months is vital in itself. It's a vital demonstration of democracy. And in a sense, no matter how electoral things go, we believe that Walker will be swept away in the election whenever it comes. But regardless of how things go, the nature of that mobilization and what Mary Jo and I have been describing and I hope is encased in this book is the central fact of the entire experience.
Mary Jo Buell, the delivery of this more than a million signatures on January 17th was so astonishing because it was almost amounted to the exact total that Scott Walker won in votes when he got elected in November 2010. And so that speaks volumes about his chances of winning. It seems unlikely at this point that he's going to be able to win. But it was to get a million signatures with 30,000 volunteers and petition signers. I mean, do the math. I mean, you've got, you know, people 30,000 people passing out petitions, getting 30 signatures or 40 signatures on each petition. I mean, it's just an extraordinary example of grassroots democracy. What is the lesson out of that?
Well, I would agree with Paul on this, that the mobilizations of last spring served as a mass sort of educational event for people. One of the sort of narratives that come up over and over again, and I heard it just minutes after the recalls were turned in when, on talk radio, were Republicans saying, I voted for Scott Walker, but I never imagined he would do this, that he would end collective bargaining or that he would be so deceptive in his attempts to trick the electorate into believing his policies were good. And the sense that the people came away with those lessons, to me, are more important than in some ways the recall itself. I mean, I don't discount that at all, but one of the things that I learned from this past year of witnessing what happened is there are so many twists and turns and unexpected events in the course of this history that nothing will surprise me now of what happens in the next few months. I'm prepared for a lot of dirty tricks on the part of the GOP. So when you say that there's no doubt that Scott Walker will be recalled, I could say, yes, if the people have their way. But on the other hand, I'm prepared for another dramatic turnabout in this unraveling story.
I do have a little doubt, I have to say, but I am hopeful for the first time in months that that's going to happen. And the sustainability of this protest over now a year's time, because I remember a protest the day Scott Walker was inaugurated, is one of the most astonishing things in this very astonishing development. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank my guests, Mary Jo and Paul Buell, and their great book. It's called It Started in Wisconsin, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Labor Protest. Thanks for being my guests.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.